Words to the Wise. We are an explicit podcast tackling content with adult themes, as well as entering spoiler territory if you aren't caught up with us. In this mini-sode, we're talking all things the First Law trilogy, so you'd better have read all of those books, them books. Hey there, this is Cross.
I am a soon-to-be intoxicated PJ.
And we are Words and Whiskey, a podcast for veteran and novice readers alike. We tackle fiction novels and love to talk about what we're drinking. You should think of us as your intoxicating weekly book club.
Crossland, before we started this episode, you asked me to go through and tabulate the number of drinks that I'll be taking. In like, we haven't paid off, I think, almost any
very
bets.
Few. Yeah,
very few bets, all trilogy. And I just didn't do that. So I am nervous about the number that we're going to reach.
Yeah.
For a while there, I got pretty liberal with my throwing out bets on things that are pretty inconsequential. So we'll, in hindsight.
I did reel it in a little bit, you know, for you and like only copied over some of the things that I thought, you know, would be relevant or otherwise. But
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
I think I tempered those down a little bit while we were going, more or less. So yeah. There were some that you were making near the end, which were kind of unhinged, though, and I've let those fly because they're unhinged and it was the end. So, but this is kind of a fun episode. We haven't done something like this, I think, ever, kind of like just paying off bets,
right?
Which is the format. No. Yeah. So yeah, we're just going to be paying off bets today from this, and then immediately afterwards, we're going to be going into a devil's cut. So PJ is going to get nice and sauced over the course of this, and then we'll have a spicy fun time for patrons talking about the Legend of Vox Machina episodes 1 through 3. Very excited to do that in kind of a informal format this time around. But yeah, very excited.
Sorry if you could hear that, everybody. I had to open up the beer because the cocktail that I made certainly doesn't have enough volume to cover.
Yeah, yeah. So to start this off, we're going to do a shot. PJ was like, we're doing a shot, right? And I was like, yeah, I guess. And he had his stuff ready. All right. Cheers. Okay. So, PJ, we're going to kick this off by talking about our drinks first. I think that logically makes the most sense given this format. So why don't you kick it off with yours?
I was having trouble thinking of a name for this, and I think I came up with one that works well. I went with the name Puppets. It is a take on a necromancer, and if you're not familiar with what that is a take on, or that's an inversion of the Corpse Reviver number 2.
Which is similar to the last word.
Which is similar to the last word. So we're stepping stones. So
think about like a just for the audience's sake, martini is a type of cocktail. Like the necromancer last word, like that whole segment is like a family of cocktails. So yeah. This is in the family.
So the traditional necromancer is made of equal parts absinthe, Lillet Blanc, elderflower liqueur, and lemon juice with a dash of gin. And that's different from a Corpse Reviver number 2 in flipping the gin and absinthe amounts. I've had multiple necromancers on the show before. If you've listened throughout our entire coverage of everything, I love that cocktail. It's very different. You really have to like absinthe in order to like it, but I think it truly can get people to like absinthe if they don't.
Yeah, if you're a fan of gin, you should like absinthe, and that's sort of like a good cocktail that way.
Yeah, it's just, it's abrasive, but it is what it is. This is very similar in that it is equal parts absinthe, Lillet Blanc, lemon juice, and I did ginger liqueur instead of elderflower liqueur. And then I did a grapefruit bitters dash instead of gin because I'm out of gin. And I thought that might go well with just adding a little bit more bitterness on top of the lemon juice and ginger. Thought could work well. And then I garnished it, or I added a twist of lemon, and then I garnished it with that lemon peel, which I cut into the shape of a crown. So it's a little coupe glass with a teeny tiny little crown on the side. I thought it was cute. And it's double-sided, so I'm like, all right, there's two kings. Let's add this double-sided crown, and both are effectively Baez's puppets. So that is where the name came from.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's a great, it sounds super good. I also love me Corpse Survivor Necromancer. So I personally am very excited to try this. I definitely have to get into the ginger liqueur space. I did just get a bottle of Lillet Blanc because I wanted to like try a couple of different vermouths against each other. So
yeah. Cool. Awesome. Excited to see what you think. And following that up for my back half beer or supplemental beer, I guess, is a Cerveza Pacifico. I have been on such a huge Mexican lager kick lately, and Pacifico is my favorite of like the widely available ones. I've still got some of my homebrew stuff, but I'm waiting until maybe to share that with more people. I don't want to just go through all of it myself. So yeah, Pacifico is a perfect summertime Mexican lager.
Perfect way to celebrate the end of summer, for sure.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Crossland? You were talking up your drink. I'm very excited to hear about it.
I am super excited. I really like my cocktail. So what it is, it's 1.5 ounces of Jamaican rum, an ounce of Aperol, 1/2 ounce of dry Curacao, 1/10 ounce or roughly 2 bar spoons of absinthe, 1 ounce of Orgeau, 1/2 ounce of lime juice, shaken, drop of saline, and a dash or two of Angostura bitters. You had pointed out that this is very similar to a jungle bird in a way, like it's akin with a jungle bird, because Aperol and Campari are in the same, I mean, they're produced by the same company, but they are literally just like kind of a watered down version of one another. There are a couple of herbal differences, I think, in general. Watered down is the wrong term, but reduced version between Aperol and Campari. And this, while sharing many of the profile or much of the profile of a jungle bird, does not taste jungle bird adjacent because Aperol is so light by comparison to the Campari. So this is like a very nice, I was struggling to explain it to you and to explain the profile fully, because there's like a round warmness here that isn't present in a lot of other cocktails, but there's also this nice rich, like that little bit of absinthe brings out a lot out of both the Aperol and the rum. So yeah, it's a very interesting cocktail that's a little bit different than like a jungle bird is. And I think that you get like this much nicer, rounder flavor here than you generally would with the jungle bird. And I like
you
that.
You mentioned a warmness, and I only bring this up because it's something that you see every once in a while in the tiki space. Generally in a drink that has like a very frothy head, like an egg white cocktail or something. But how would that do with some nutmeg, like some freshly grated nutmeg?
I did think nutmeg could be good on top of this when I tasted it at first. And then I went and I added the Angostura dash, and that basically supplemented it the way that I thought it would. Nutmeg would basically just kind of double down on the same sort of thing and like make it even warmer. And if that's your vibe, for sure do it. I think in this case, that'd be a little bit
over.
I don't think it would be too much, but it would be like doubling down on the same thing that I just doubled down on by adding the Ango.
Okay.
To kind of round it out. Because it definitely needed the dash of Ango and the little bit of, I put a drop of saline in it, stirred the whole thing up, and that kind of left us where we're at. But it's very good. I'm calling it Glistrod's True Apprentice, a.k.a. Baez, a.k.a. but I feel like it's a celebratory cocktail of sort of a chaotic mixture. I just wanted to play with Aperol and rum, and I thought that would be interesting, and then kind of just went to a couple of go-tos and saw how it shook out in an odd ratio. So
nice.
It's very tasty. This would be a perfect pool cocktail for someone who wants a sipper for like an hour.
All right.
Yeah.
And how did you put it into a tiku or like a wine glass, right?
Yeah, I put an IPA glass actually specifically, but it's a,
yeah.
But yeah, I figured that was I could have put it into the nice sour glass that you gave me, but I was afraid that it was going to be a little bit too much volume. So I was like, it was towing the line of volume. Mm-hmm. So instead I put it in this guy.
Cool. Yeah. I remembered that I saw it before I asked. I didn't know if you served it on ice or up.
No, you could. I also think that there's a cocktail here in which you lengthen this out with a little bit of club soda and you put a little bit more lime in it, I think. You'd put like another 1/4 ounce of lime, lengthen it in with club soda and throw some ice in. Like, then it would be a pool sipper for sure.
If you lengthen it even more with both club soda and champagne, a really weird tiki take on an Aperol spritz.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it would, yeah, a rummy take on an Aperol spritz, which is fun. Mm-hmm. But that absinthe shines through nicely without being overwhelming too. And that little bit of dry curacao really kind of like mellow or like mixes the herbaceous notes well. So
sounds good.
It's more complicated than I'd like in some cases, like for a cocktail, you know, generally you like to play within like the 4 or 5 ingredient space, but yeah.
Yeah. But Tiki gets crazy.
Yeah. Tiki gets weird. Following that up, I'm having a Wicked Weed Brewing Freak of Nature, which is their double IPA. They are out of, I think, Charlotte, if I remember. No, shit. They're out of Asheville. And Asheville has been hit by a very, very, very big storm this last week. We've sent some food and some money and a variety of supplies, my friends and people have. So, yeah, if you can, donate to support, absolutely do. There's a lot that's going on there, and a lot of people are lending aid, including FEMA and otherwise. It's just kind of crazy to be hit by the amount of flooding that East Tennessee, Asheville, and Georgia was in this hurricane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, did it? You know, I was curious.
A mountain community does not prepare for
unaffected by it, considering
entirely unaffected.
Didn't hear anything from you about it, and you were like texting me memes and stuff like normal. So I'm like, all right, he's probably fine. But
yeah, there was a little bit of rain the first night that it was coming over, but it was nothing more than that here.
Okay.
But also, just for comparison's sake too, this community in general, Wilmington, Leland, kind of the surrounding area, is prepared for hurricanes much better.
You guys deal with them
than Asheville is
a couple times a year.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Asheville is a mountain town that got hit with hurricane level rains. So that's the problem here.
Yeah. Some of those pictures were absolutely heartbreakingly nuts.
Yeah. There are a lot of devastating pictures, videos, photos, et cetera. Some of the journalism up there has been incredible in general. So I'm glad that it's gotten the exposure so that it also in turn gets the support that it needs. But yeah. Mm-hmm. So. But having a beer from the generally brewed and canned in Asheville, yeah, didn't plan that. Didn't think about it. I was like, I think they're a Charlotte company, but no.
Hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, Asheville, big, very big brewery town.
All right, cool. With that, we're going to get into the bets, BJ. We've got some bets to pay off here in a variety of fashions. So I left a couple of these on the plate that we had like kind of paid off just because there were some lingering elements. So a couple of these we've like partially paid off, or we paid off one of four in some circumstances. So
I'll pay them off. Just again. So it's all good.
Yeah.
I'm not in some cases, you try to keep track of that.
I kind of did though, all right. But well, it's fine. So with that, we're going to start off with the earliest chronological bet that you made that we didn't pay off, which is from the chapter in Offer and a Gift, which is way early on in the blade itself. So I'm going to read the text as I mostly said it at that point, which is, then comes the gift, a single duel to decide the war as opposed to the martial bloodshed that would occur and is a gift of their lives. Fenris, the feared, then stabs himself through his tattooed arm, spilling blood all over the ground. The terrifying man goes around the room, extends the offer, and Giselle in this moment can't help but open his mouth and say, well, I would, but I'm terribly busy this afternoon. Perhaps tomorrow?
First of all, I just have to say, I love the fact that like this whole war ended again with a one-on-one battle to the death with Fenris the Feared. So that was pretty cool.
It ended the way it was to begin.
How this is how I responded. I think you probably like, I don't know. What the fuck, Giselle, was the first part of that. I don't think that says anything about the bet. I want to know if this is some sort of nervous slip up or something else based on his thoughts. He didn't seem to really want to say this. Based on some magical effects we were exposed to later, particularly by the sorceress against Logan, I have a suspicion that someone is persuading Giselle in this moment. Whether it is Fenris himself or another person in the room, I am unsure. I have my conspiracy eyes on Artie right now. He is magically being fucked with, and Artie is the one fucking with him. It was like the official end of that bet. Like that, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Seems like no.
Seems like a confident no, but also not something that like you could confidently say no about until I couldn't like say no because there was enough like mysterious entities circling around the room of like, ooh, who's messing with them in their sleep? It's Ptolemy.
Was Ptolemy there at that point?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She eats quiet really early upon their arrival into the city. So,
yeah. I just didn't remember if Kwai and Baez were in the room.
I don't think they were in the room at that point, but Ptolemy had been out and around and messing with people's brains to some degree. So,
okay. Well,
yeah. That's a you. That's a drink that for me. You.
Okay.
So the next bet is one that you kind of conjured up out of nowhere, which I think was a really interesting prospect in general, for the record, because
it had
there's
been
nothing to
my
say
head for a while.
Yeah, yeah. And there's nothing to say that I don't think that the idea is bad and that you couldn't also draw parallels, but your parallels were off. So we're gonna just judge this based on the fact that they're off, I think.
Yeah.
So to clarify, the bet was that the four companions are relatives of Ayus' sons, Glistrod, Badesh, Juvens, and Canadius. And you chose various characters for various people, so if you want to call those out, and then maybe we can talk about if we think there are other alignments here.
Yeah, so I chose Malachus for Glistrod, Logan for Badesh, Dizal for Juvens, and Pharaoh for Canadius. Yeah.
Oh.
I guess Malachus, very obviously not Glistrod, but...
Actually, though... They're kind of, and that's because she does talk to the other side,
and she does like accept that, like following Glustrod's path.
Yeah, I mean, there's an argument in my head for Kwai being either Canadius more clearly because that is like she's
actually
related, yes, or Glustrod. I think there's a good argument there on either stretch. So.
But I think to the greater point of this. There was not a one-to-one.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. You're drinking for this, period. I will drink for Badesh and Logan because that was a call out. And I think we called these each individual drinks at the time in the episode as
well. We did. We did. So I'll take three.
Canadius we can talk about. I don't think that aligns with Pharaoh, though. I think Pharaoh aligns closer with Glistrod even, perhaps.
Yeah, demonic.
Yeah. Like going with... But she doesn't, like, parallel that necessarily as a character. Anyway, I do kind of want to debate. So, real quick, the characters you said, Malachus, Glistrod, Logan, Badesh, Jizal, Juvens, Pharaoh, Canadius. Again, just repeating that here. Logan and Badesh, I think, make logical sense. There's no one else that Spirit talks that, like, just is kind of the way that it is.
Which is why I guessed it. Like, yeah. I think that reveal is when I made this bet.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the last sort of link that made me put this forward as a thought.
Yeah. But who do you think the other three of Ayus' sons match to most closely in the plot, considering all the characters, all we know, and everything else?
The thing is, we still only have so many magical characters, you know?
Sure. But it can be their intentions. It can be a variety of things.
Yeah, that's fair. I'm thinking like straight lineage as opposed to
sure.
Spiritual successors. Yeah. I'm curious about Kwai as Kwai was, not as Ptolemy. I wish we would have gotten to know him a little bit better as a standalone person. But, I mean, we also have Yoru. So maybe Yoru is the better Glustrod descendant or relation. So if we put Malachus / Ptolemy under Canadius, we've got Logan under Badesh, we've got maybe Pharaoh under Juvens then?
But do you think that lines up logically?
That's the one that still doesn't. Like I have so many that can point to Glustrod.
Who did you say, Glistrod? Who's your pro?
Yoru? But Pharaoh makes more sense there, too.
So, to me, from my perspective, here's what I would say from my ranking. To me, and I'm going to stretch outside of what we were using as comparisons a little bit here, maybe, and consider some people that didn't immediately come to mind, or maybe you feel like is a bridge too far. I would say... that if we're talking about people that are who's who, I did make the joke earlier that Baez is Glistrod's apprentice. I do believe that Baez and Glistrod are the most closely aligned in a lot of ways. Pursuit, perhaps, through the means of Juvens. I do think that Kalul, of whom set out the laws in many ways, or saw the hypocrisy in the laws and continued to do so anyway, lines up with Juvens, especially in Juvens being willing to break the first law in many ways in order to practice art, in order to do it in the first place, and then Kalul breaking the second law, you know, to some degree. So I view them as similar in their own right. The remainder falls down to Bidesh, and this is going to be my rogue take. Sorry, not Ptolemy. I wanted Pharaoh in Bidesh, in Bidesh's spot, because of her ability not to talk to spirits exactly, but talking and controlling and or managing her demons pretty well, as we see her kind of saying no at the end. I think that that aligns with sort of the spirit of spirit talking, in that they're more advisors than anything else, you know, or they're more,
more grounded. So I took that as
a spiritual successor.
Yeah, I like that read. I took that as an extension on her ability to withstand pain.
Sure.
Or her inability to feel pain.
I mean,
and extending that from the physical into the sort of emotional and sort of stressful angles of things.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I like that read too.
Yeah. To be clear, I very much vibe with that idea as well. I think that clears for me. I think that does leave kind of this question mark for me in the space of Canadius. And I'll tell you what, I'm going to put Mr. Glockta in Mr. Canadius's spot. And here's why. Glockta has done a great job building a personal network of people that he can manage or manipulate, and also is capable of building a continuous empire, as is proven kind of at the end of the series. I think Glockta and Canadius share a lot in the ways of understanding the world. Maybe that aligns more with Juvens than Canadius, but I don't know.
Hmm.
That's my read.
Yeah. All right.
I really liked this question when you brought it up, or when you brought up this equation. I spent a lot of the series at different points kind of checking in with this prediction in my own head and like thinking through where different characters were at. It's a good one.
It was
fun. But Yoru as Glistrod, I think, is also good. I like your kind of second round there.
Yeah, I mean, it's solely because of the eater thing, you know?
Yeah. Makes sense. Makes sense to me. Okay. All right. From there, we will move on a little bit further into the series. I believe this is in Before They're Hanged now at this point. Actually, even the last one was Before They Were Hanged. Vitari's seeming change of heart for her continued survival and admittance to the reason that she served Salt so faithfully over the years is refreshing. And the way that she turns to Glockta looking for that eventual escape hatch from the Archlector. What do you make of her decision? It's so funny reading back these sentences because I have to fill them in still because they are not complete thoughts. A lot of them are total fragments that I just like know how to complete. And that's how I write these notes. So, yeah, I'm like an autocomplete bot for my own sentences. Anyway,
my answer to that is she's a wily one. I'm inclined to take her at her word right now. The logic makes sense. Then again, I could totally see this as an elaborate sting operation. And I think the official bet that I made was Vitari is not switching allegiances. This is an elaborate ploy.
Indeed it was. Now, this one is maybe the most debatable of most of these that I think are down here for the most part.
It's hard to call. Because I don't know if she was always on the, like, she eventually starts working for Salt again, but I don't know if she always was. Like, I think she kind of, when in Salt's presence, maybe Salt knew about her children too, and she just kind of had to go along with it. But while away, she could kind of stretch, but I'm not sure.
She also warned Glockta to pay back her debt, you know? And that was... It was more like a debt exchange than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So
I don't think it was an elaborate ploy on her part, though.
Yeah.
Either way.
But I don't think she also swapped allegiances. I would call this one, personally, a like narrow push. If I'm getting like really picky about the way that I think you came off on the whole thing. So it's one apiece. Unless you, really
I think
do
I'm
it
wrong.
Otherwise.
I think it, just in okay. my estimation, in my like where I was coming from with it, I don't think.
Sure.
This rings true.
Sure. All right. Cool. That's on you
like,
then.
The biggest part of this was this is an elaborate ploy, as in she was truly acting on. I mean, we get the reveal that Frost is the one spying on Glockta for the Archlector the entire mm-hmm. goddamn time. And I right. think had it been Vitari,
Severard is for this the bank. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the spirit of it was wrong.
Mm-hmm. Fair. You know, talking about Frost and Severard for a second, what a great reveal, that the two of them also so early on in this book compared to where everything else happens, which is crazy. But the Severard reveal hurts so much worse on reread because Glockta is torturing him and he's told the truth. And we know the depth to which he's told the truth because it's all that he knows and understands versus like Glockta sees something else very clearly wrong and misses out on Frost and the whole thing with him. Meanwhile, Severard very literally was giving him as much as he could. And it was, you know, and then to also know that he was Baez's little toy basically to get at Glockta the whole time is... That's the one that hurts. That's the one that stings for me. Frost
I'm
is
curious
okay,
if he
but...
knew.
No, he didn't know that it was Baez. He okay. There's no way. He's
yeah, no.
It's
he would have given that up.
It's the 4D chess. Yeah, he would have said for sure. Mm-hmm. It's the 4D chess of Baez being extracted from that.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, that one hurts. Speaking of Baez, you want to read your next one?
Quai kills his Baez. Is. Nope.
She tries her hardest. She tries really
it
hard.
It also wasn't fucking Quai.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Wasn't Quai to begin with.
And wasn't Quai at that point either.
Yep. Right. Right. Yeah. Very, very funny to me. The next one I'll read here for you, but you had bet that Dognan loses everyone else and is alone again. And damn it, is that true at the end of this? Technically, I guess you could say he has Black Dao yet, but oh my God, do you think so?
Yeah. I think despite Black Dao being alive, Dogman has been effectively put into isolation.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And tough. Lost almost everyone else to actual, mm-hmm. like, actual mud.
Mm-hmm. Yep, to the mud. To the mud. All right.
But PJ believes the haunting dream spirit to be none other than Mamoon, leader of the 100 words.
I did make you drink for this one in the episode, but before you take a drink, you can drink again if you want. The reason I left this one in and didn't delete it, which is usually what I do with predictions, is because he does kind of show up like a haunting spirit in the very end. So it's like, well, kind of. He shows up in the exact same fashion that we've got used to the spirits showing up.
Yeah,
like he isn't the haunting dream spirit, but he does show up. I think you still drink, but I'm going to take a sip of beer because it was a funny note, and you were correct without being correct. You know, yeah. You're correct for different reasons.
Hit the dartboard accidentally.
Yes, yeah. Which is it was just fun for me when you said that. I was like, oh, okay, fun. It's a good one. Okay, so a bet that you had the next week. You want to read it?
The eater in Glockta's dream is most certainly, without a doubt, no other than Carlotte Danida, ex-head of the Guild of Spicers, widower of Mr. Danida, ex-head of the Guild of Spicers again, former councilwoman of Degaska, noted traitor of the Union, notable baddie.
Baldy. No, Baldy. Yeah. Because she shaved that.
She's a notable baddie, too, I think.
Yeah. Also true. Both clear. I did specifically take this out of increasing context out of your voice because I thought it was funny when you were kind of going through. I was like, it will be funny to write this out very specifically.
You just kept adding
because
things.
I did. Well, I did. I was like, okay. Yeah.
While
right.
you were
I was like,
it.
Yeah. 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 Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Duke Orso prediction. Syria yeah, is going to mount an attack on the Union.
Wow, that one kind of stings, doesn't it?
He mounted an attack on Union soil.
But was it against the Union, which is what I think the heart of your statement
implies but doesn't say?
I was pretty sure you're like, he's going to betray Jizal. Like, that was yeah. the entire... Yeah,
that was
yeah,
the whole
you were,
point.
You were on this, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Cocktail's gone. It's a good cocktail.
Yeah.
Man, I love me some absinthe.
Absinthe's good, man. People are sleeping on it because of the, you know, their thoughts of the whole wormwood thing.
And it's a higher proof spirit to begin with. It's a and very intense and, flavor. You know, there's a lot to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Duke Orso, though, man, I've already told you, you know well, that we're going to Styria next book, so.
Mm-hmm. You have told me so.
Yes. Yep. Ho, ho, ho. All right. Cool. Well, Duke Orso did not attack. He, in fact, helped and was ultimately like the winning force for the most part on the ground, I think, between him and, yeah, mostly just him. The arrival of the Union Army was good, too, but.
A lot went their way.
Sealed the deal.
A lot helped.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So next up.
Dogman dies this book.
Mm-hmm.
His spirit kind of does.
His soul did, you know, based on the above statement. He did lose everyone.
But I'll drink.
It's fair. Throwing up the next one.
One of the duo of generals dies. One becomes a legit general.
Which does happen.
I think that's pretty much exactly how that happens.
It's pretty much exactly how
it
happens.
They were already
legit
generals. Like, they were both already legit generals, so I don't know what I was saying.
I definitely transcribed this incorrectly from, like, your final round of bets, which is what most of this comes from. I was a little intoxicated when I was making you make these. So you were definitely intending... Yes, clearly. But you were intending to say, or, like, intending Lord Marshall from general. So
okay,
that was sort of the thought process.
Yeah, Croy which is exactly what happens. Yeah, the other Lord Marshal.
Mm-hmm. But now there's another vacancy.
Jizal dies and the realm is thrown into chaos. That is both wrong and I think would have been wrong, even if he did.
Yeah, the realm would have not gave a shit because Baez does not care about his bastard king, but it isn't even a part of the line of kings.
Makes me wonder how many of the kings were part of that line.
All in due time.
Fair enough.
In its own fun ways. I'm so excited. I don't think I mentioned this to you. I think I put it in the Discord the other day, but chatting just in general, I've been very excited to read this book. I read through the section and I read all of part one because that is the entirety of what we read. And I started part two and I went, no, you need to slow down. You need to go back. You need to do notes. But I read too far. So now I have to reread the whole thing so that I don't fuck up the notes. Because I don't want to just off the hip be like, ah, yes, and then we go to that place, and then we kill that person. And wait, mm-hmm. What? So, yeah. I'm so excited for the depth of these next several books. You have no idea. And I know that a lot of our listeners are, a lot of our patrons are, too, because a lot of them have read the First Law trilogy, but haven't read the standalones. So this is kind of a fun experience with a lot of the people that have been with us for a long time on the podcast, where it's like, ooh, it's our first time stepping beyond the First Law as it was originally written. So,
and I know at least a few people are, like you mentioned, but beyond that, joining me for the first time as somebody who hasn't read the books yet.
Yeah,
through all of our series.
Yep. Yeah, and there are a handful that are also like through the entire series, but a lot of people haven't read beyond the First Law, so they've got seven books in front of them to read inside of the series. So very exciting. Very exciting. Kind of read along here. So next up, you said Glockta and Ardy get together. And this is a fun one because I think you were kind of like, you're like, kind of wishy-washy on this one. You're like, I don't know. It feels like that would be like the culmination of their plot, but the rationale as it comes out is far stronger than,
it works a lot better than what I was even postulating in my head at that point.
Your suppositions.
Yeah. I really like the way that this goes, but I would say I was entirely wrong with like the reason. Like, of course I was wrong with the reasoning, but it's blossomed into, or it seems to have blossomed into a truly romantic relationship. Or maybe not romantic yet, but a truly loving relationship, I think, so far.
Yeah, it is. It is a complex relationship, that's for sure.
It's caring. It's caring, and I would say loving, but I don't know about romantic.
It has big, and I never live for this trope. I've never like particularly understood. I just don't get why people like really like it, but it is very much like an arranged marriage. It reminds me in some ways of Warbreaker and sort of that thing that's going on, outside of the fact that these people opted into it, well, kind of, for the survival of each other, you know, or for the survival of one party at the very least. But there's,
yeah,
it has elements that makes me feel like an arranged marriage.
I can see where you're coming from,
but there's history, which is better. Like there's, yeah, there's history here, which is better.
And they're not, they're being forced into it, but they're not being forced into it by external parties. They're forcing themselves into it.
Kind of. It's like that or die, right? Like that's the,
yeah, but it's not like they're being pushed together by, yeah, they still kind of are. You're right. Yeah. You can still make those same comparisons. Yeah.
Right. Hmm. It has arranged marriage vibes. I wouldn't call it strictly an arranged marriage, though. Like, I understand where you're coming from, like, debating it, because I agree similarly that it's like, it isn't the same as a blind arranged marriage. This is an intentional marriage with history, but it is, I don't know, like, growing up, I'm sure you did this, but at some point, did you make like a promise to a friend that like, if we're not married by 25, we'll get married? It very much has that vibe to it of like childhood future, like, I don't want to be alone vibes. If that makes sense.
I don't know if I ever did that, but okay, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, I don't, I agree more with the arranged marriage than I do with that.
Sure.
But
fair enough. I was just trying to give like a semblance. I was trying to give like a semblance of like structure to it.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Okay.
Cool. Fair enough. Final little tidbit here. We have the little last prediction that you made, which is
this is Shiver's last stand. That wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned in. Eventually, there was one. Then he like ripcorded out of it.
Yeah. I'm gonna drink for you out of the ambiguous state of this, or we can push and both
drink.
I think
we push.
Because the only other detail that I will tell you about the future of this series in general is that we are not done with Mr. Shivers. But when and where, who knows?
Cool.
So that brings us to the end of the written predictions here that we have. I'm curious about the next 6 or 7 books. And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more of this with Mike when we do that wrap up when we're recording on Monday. But do you have any other thoughts or theories or ideas about the future of the series? We're not going to hold these to like bets or predictions or anything like that, but I'm just curious where your mind goes with both the next 3 books and maybe the 3 after that.
I think we're going to get a little bit of a format change.
Okay.
In that, instead of having a group of, I think whatever our point of views are already all in the same location, all in the same vicinity. And the next 3 books are going to be more singularly focused on one area in one smaller part of the world, like Styria, as you mentioned. Am I allowed to know if it is? I think at least one of the books is not in chronological order. I think we go backwards.
Well, Sharp Ends.
I know
backwards.
That. Yeah.
Okay.
I know.
Yeah. None of the other books do. I'll go ahead and like clarify that at the very least, because I think the line is advancing outside of Sharp Ends. Sharp Ends has interstitials from before the series, in the middle of the standalones, and before the second series. I'll tell you that. It is a collection of stories that broadens the whole gap of time and like fills in some spaces, which are fun.
Cool. Okay.
It is, I think I've mentioned this, definitely we've talked about it again in the Discord with other people who have read the series. Sharp Ends is my favorite short story collection that is connected to a larger series. It is easily the best in so many different ways.
Sweet.
Yeah.
And then finally, as a shot in the dark, I think Carla Dan Ida is going to be a perspective.
Okay. Cool. That's a good one. I have maybe one more question for you on top of those, or maybe two. Yeah, two. Just because we haven't done any speculating whatsoever at this point. Where do you think we go with both Baez in general, as well as Black Dow?
Ooh.
Because those are kind of maybe two of the biggest cliffhangers, kind of, in the series so far, I think. Pharaoh as well.
Yeah, I could see Baez being just gone for a while. Like, we just don't know what's going on with him. But eventually, he'll definitely come back. So, is he going back to the edge of the world to put the seed back there? Just where you thought it was going to be in the first place? Stash it away that way? That'd be good. Or to kill all the other Magi. That's it. That's what he is. He's on a campaign to kill the other Magi. Be the last one standing.
First and last of the Magi?
Yep. The Alpha and Omega of the Magi.
That does clock with a lot of Baez's sort of stuff. But he feels pretty indifferent for the most part to a lot of his peers outside of Kel-El.
For some reason, he does still feel compelled to...
He belittles them, for sure.
He belittles them, but he also feels like he needs to explain himself to them.
That's
every
fair.
Time he comes across them.
Mm-hmm. So, Yulway.
And
Conniel.
Zacharias.
And Zacharias.
And Conniel.
All,
like, all of them. Everybody that he's interacted with. Even Mamoon. There's some elements of that. And he's not even like one of the Magi. So just for his own ego's sake, eliminate the quote unquote competition.
Yeah. Okay.
And then Black Dao. I'd like to see Black Dao also become a perspective in one of the stories. See him start to lead his own faction.
Fucked up in the head, but cool.
Yeah. I mean, he'll run off with Scale and
Calder,
and maybe try to start
any
another
of them are King in the North.
Yeah, Bethod-esque uprising. Ooh, yeah. If Logan's gone, presumed dead again, maybe the Black Dao hypothetically killed him, and they have established he who kills a king becomes the king. So Black Dao crowns himself. Yeah, I think that's where it goes.
Cool.
But I also would like to see it be his perspective, too.
Any other erroneous predictions? Any other characters you're thinking about? Jizal? I mean, Jizal, Arty, Glockta?
Longfoot?
Ooh, Longfoot. Okay.
It'd be interesting to come across him again.
I internally, personally suffer a lot when Glockta tortures Longfoot inside of these books. Because He is broken as a person. He's still the same kind of core person, the same egotist in a lot of ways, but reduced in grand fashion by his torture.
Right. God, there's more. Fucking everybody, man.
I know. Yeah. I'm just curious if there's any lingering brain worms.
Vitaria would be interesting to come back across if we know for sure that curly haired person with the child wasn't Vitaria.
Yeah. Or the rest of her children, you know, they could have made it out. Yeah.
Right. Well, we know they did. They did make it out. Because Glockta.
Well, that assumes that Vitari made it out, in that same supposition.
They made it out beforehand. Her children did. Because Glockta was bluffing that he stopped them. He was just guessing when they would have left.
Yeah. But the way that the text reads is such that he suggests in the end that Vitari and her children fled entirely. And then we see from Jizal's perspective a redhead of whom died with a child.
We see a curly head, but not red.
Curly haired, not redhead. That was the defining factor. Because it isn't explicitly red. That's what I kept bringing up. Sorry, I thought it was the other way around. Yeah. But we explicitly see someone with curly hair, not necessarily red.
And a single child, I think.
Yeah. So I guess my point was, is that if that was Vitari and a child, her other children could be out there.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
That was kind of orphans effectively, but.
Right. I think they'd be pretty well capable band of orphans.
They could be the heroes. Yeah. Who says they couldn't be the heroes? If you look at our book titles.
Right. I knew that one was coming up.
Yeah. Any predictions on the book titles? now that we're there. Best Served Cold, The Heroes, Red Country. I'll tell you, we get a map. I'll tell you, we get a map. Okay. Yeah. We get a map of the subcontinents before we get a full map, but we get a map of, I think, Styria first.
Okay. Do we ever get to know what the circle of the world means? Is it a flat earth?
No, it's not a flat earth.
It's not the disc of the world. Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's very funny that you asked that, because I believe there was a recent interview published that Jackson Dickert did, and he's an interviewer and a writer and a very funny guy. And he's been running this series called Between Two Perns.
You've talked about
two copies. Yeah. Okay. And he interviewed Joe Abercrombie, and he asked a couple of questions that were adjacent to that, including like something that was very close to, is it a flat earth? Yeah. A lot of great stuff in that interview. You could watch 85% of that interview. There's a question about the Age of Madness that you cannot hear. It's segmented out. So maybe I'll send it to you so you could listen, but it's so funny.
All right. Dope.
Yeah.
So best served cold.
That's in Styria. We go to Styria in Best Served Cold. Yeah.
Okay. Obviously a revenge focused story. Yeah, I think Carlot. I think that follows Carlot.
Cool. The
heroes. Yeah, why the fuck not? Let's make it an official bet. It's Vitari's children.
Just for the reference of things that we've talked about before on this podcast, that isn't really a spoiler. This is a direct inspiration for Dark Age. I just want to float that. You've read Dark Age.
I have read Dark Age. I still think it's Vitari's children, and I'm
cool. Love it.
I'm stamping my name on that answer.
All right.
And Red Country. Back in the north, whole lot of blood.
Whole lot of blood in Red Country. All right. Cool. Sounds good. It sounds fun. Sweet. All right. Well, with that, we'll just mention a little bit about next week. At this point, this is going to either be paired up or released with very near our wrap-up episode with Mike of Mike's Books Reviews, of whom is excellent, and we're very excited to chat with at this point about the entirety of the First Law trilogy as it is. We are going to, though, the following week, be starting Best Served Cold, my favorite book as an adult. I love it very dearly. We are going to be reading the entirety of part one to kick us off. So that is from the prologue, Bene Mercado saves a life, through up until the part two, which is Westport, I believe is what it's named. If you give me a half a second here, I will find the chapter as I texted it to PJ. I could grab my book, but it's just out of reach, and PJ doesn't have his book yet. Nope, I didn't give you the chapter. Hang on.
Yeah, you did.
No, I didn't. I just scrolled up and I did not give you the chapter. I read through our text messages. Bloody instructions. Through bloody instructions.
You say prologue up until Westport.
Yeah, which is part two. Like, Westport is the part two break, which is what I said. But through bloody instructions, which will get you to Westport part two.
I get you. Okay.
Yeah, so it's more of that. Yeah. Super duper excited to start this bad boy. You can see copious notes and chapters. I've got one section that I'm going to be splitting up tonight, and then the whole thing will be published. So this will be published by the time you're listening to this. You will be able to read our schedule. I want to say it's 12 episodes. It's a little bit longer than Last Argument with a little bit less words, but that's partially because of pacing and some of the other things that the book does. So it's intentional, I promise, but we're going to be reading this one for a little bit, breaking it down, talking about it, because I fucking love it, too. And holiday season. I don't want to make it too tough on us by going too fast. So,
right.
Very, very excited to talk about this one for the next couple months.
Me too.
Sweet.
This is
all right.
Top book for you, period?
This is my favorite book that I've read in my adult life.
High praise.
This is the book. This is my book. This is part of the reason we even read the last trilogy, was to make this make sense to some degree. So,
all right.
I'm very excited. There are other books that I found affecting in very different ways, but this just encompasses so many things that I love and adore. and does such a good job with so many of them. So I can't wait to live in Monza Mercado's shoes. Oh my God, please just do the adaptation. Please just do it. Just come on, fucking do it. All right, cool. With that, okay. We will see you next week. Check out our Patreon. Check out everything else. You know the deal.
Yeah.
You get it.
You get it.
You understand. Cool. We'll see you next week.